Welcome everyone, new and old. Imaginary or real. So tonight we're going to be overseen by Yama, the Lord of Death.
Oh, good.
That's the person who is, or the entity that's holding this wheel of life with his jaws, being held by his teeth, if you can see that. And this basically is called Wheel of Life. I realize for people in the back it's going to be hard to see, but you're welcome to come up later and look at it, and please do, because it's very rich. And what we're doing now is just briefly to catch up. We've been studying the nature of mind. We're studying how the mind works. We're studying what the construction of our confused reality is. And we're learning about how to undo our predicament, work through our predicament, discover our entrapment, and find the way to liberate. From the point of view of what we call the Hinayana, which is primarily based on self-liberation, that's done for the sake of oneself and to bring peace in general. In the sake of Mahayana, we're looking at the means to establish all beings in the state of liberation and Buddhahood. So with that preface, we can sort of begin to understand what we're looking at. Last week, we were talking about consciousness, which is the fifth skanda, or a pile, or there are various terms for skandhas, but it's basically this system of overlaying kind of ways we continuously enter and leave states of confusion. Mostly stay, or mostly are just caught up in it. So what we're doing here is talking about what actually the construction is of this samsara, we call, which is a state of confusion, state of what we call suffering. It's suffering because, basically, we're not real. We're not in reality. And that's not good. Reality is good. That's the first thing. You know, we learn about Dharma. It's not like the horrible truth. It's the wonderful truth. But it hurts a little bit. So, basically, what we call the nidanas are links of causation. And they describe what's called interdependence. Interdependence is basically the notion that nothing exists of itself alone, but is simply a concatenation and a manifestation of a continuing process of cause and effect. That's not too hard to get. And in the context of the Hinayana, it's basically understood to help us understand how we can counteract the idea of oneself as some kind of an agent, because we tend to believe we are an independent agent. Remember, this is the difficulty we have, because we have this continuous belief that we exist, and that basically we are fundamentally in charge of our life. Well, this is a really misguided point of view. So what we're going to learn about is that that there's, once we actually begin to understand this, it's much easier to learn how to work with the dynamics that come up in our experience, make friends with ourselves, and actually learn how to fundamentally lift ourselves out of this confusion. In the in the Hinayana, the basic approach is to understand and study these nidanas as a means to basically establish a state of renunciation. And I'll explain where that occurs in the Hinayana. In the Mahayana, we do it very differently. We're going to, first of all, start with a sequential process of going from what we call the first nidana to the 12th. But in the case of the Mahayana, we're going backwards. We start by asking questions. Why earth? Why old age and death? What is this? I don't know if anyone had a chance to read the posting we put on the website, which basically lists the nidanas with a very brief description. But anyway, that you may have been introduced to this or read it somewhere else. And so you know, what we're talking now about what we call inner phenomena as distinct from outer phenomena. Outer phenomena can be described as a series of traceable experiences or traceable sequences that occur. For instance, if you take a question of a plant, you start with a seed, which can go into a leaflet or a sprout, coming into a stem, bud, flower, fruit, then producing another seed, the cycle of birth and death, as it were. Inner phenomena is describing the nature of how our mind arises, dwells, and ceases, how our thought processes, how we get snagged and caught up in fundamental state of delusion. And so we left off last week when we talked about the eight states, the eight consciousnesses. Does everyone remember that? Well, in the Mahayana teachings, there are eight stages of consciousness, eight consciousnesses. And the last one we were talking about is called Alaya. Alaya, that's the big storehouse, the big kind of repository of all of our fundamental experiences, our impulses, our karma, the baggage, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'll start right from there when we talk about ignorance. The first nidana is ignorance. And ignorance is basically the alaya itself. And so what we learned about last week was, first we should just talk about the ignorance. Okay. Is anybody questioning anything so far? Are we all okay about this? Okay. So, we're talking about, actually, as I say, a chain or a process that really just drives us and lives through us. And we become simply catapulted through this cycle of experience. Again and again and again. This is not a one-time deal. It can describe both the structure of a lifetime or the cycles of a lifetime. And also in that cycle itself, there's continuous cycles of birth, old age, sickness, death, the whole process of getting impulse and, you know, catching it or being caught by it and cycling through this process. So let's explore this. So this ignorance, the first one is called ignorance, not knowing. And so the fundamental ignorance is an ignorance of impermanence, because we really think things are going to stick around. We think something's real, mm-hmm. and we think we can grasp onto something and hold on to it, and we can find it again. And you know, we have this kind of state of bewilderment comes as a result of recognizing we don't know, but we don't know that we don't know. And so fundamentally, ignorance is basically ignorant of impermanence, suffering, egolessness. That's called the three marks of existence. We imagine a continuous self and stubbornly hold to our basic projections, impermanence, unaware. And it's, so each of these characteristics, as you'll come up, you'll see little beings in each one of these little descriptions of the 12 nidanas. And the first one is the blind grandmother.
So it's the outer ring, right?
Yeah, the outer ring.
Can't see point of
one. This is it. It's in here.
Oh, no, those are the sprouts.
No, it's this thing.
This is the outer ring. So. She should be right at the top.
Yeah. Right.
Here she is. She's got a little stick.
There she is. Yeah, that's
she's
right.
Stick.
So yeah, I have no idea where she's going.
I'll point to it.
All right, I'll point to it. You can come up and see it later. This is basically subconscious gossip. It isn't as though we can't experience this or access it, but without meditation practice and actually bearing witness, as it were, to fundamentally the fickleness of our mind, it's very hard to really basically understand that this is going on continuously.
I just had an insight.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's blind because she has no insight, which is prajna. So we've talked so much about that before. You know, prajna is that awake mind. And so she's blind, or he's blind. There's two of them, I think, up there. So that they don't see So that is ignorance. It's not being stupid. It's just not seeing.
Not seeing. Not seeing. Right.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of crowded space in this ignorance, and basically it creates a certain sense of claustrophobia. And so this is the fundamental issue, which then stirs up a lot of. And so, if you remember, there was a seventh consciousness we talked about last week, which is the one who comes in and does all the dirty work, as it were. That's the one that goes and, as it were, blows on the, stirs the winds or blows the waters and starts this whole process going from the ignorance, the alaya. And that goes, so we're coming into the second nidana, which is formation or karmic patterns. And that's described as a potter's wheel. So there we go. And what we have there is basically it's a series of... So the word samskara, which Michael had brought up regarding what's in the fourth skanda, this is actually another term. This is also called samskara because it's where all the elements are present, both positive, negative, and virtuous, unvirtuous, and indifferent or non-agitated, neutral. And they're all produced by passion, aggression, and ignorance. And so this is the accumulation of constantly spinning. When we talk about primordial ground or the basic space, is that we find the reason we get lost in the first place is because we're spinning in space. And we spin out of control. And this is where it starts to happen. So there's this spinning constantly. This is called karmic creation. So then the next thing that gives rise to, because each of these are giving rise to the next sequence, is consciousness, what we call consciousness.
I just thought of an image for number mm-hmm. two. I don't know if anyone goes to those fairs where they make that candy cotton. Yeah, it's cotton. Spinning around and around, yeah. And you get all this, and it looks really beautiful, and you take one bite, and the whole thing dissolves.
Also, yeah. I know that one of the mamas in the retreat, who was explaining the potter, he was making different sized pots. And I thought that was interesting. So there's different kinds of karma one accumulates. That's the way he made it in terms of the formation of pots.
Yeah.
So this consciousness is basically the monkey. And this is the notion of I am. And basically I am is a dualistic statement. I being somehow an alleged subject, and am being an object. And so the am is a little trickier than I because it's very hard to discover I. But we can actually, through our practice, discover fundamentally nobody's there. Am is required more work and takes a little longer time. That's more like what we call Dharma, the world that we basically think is real. So this is all part of what starts to escalate samsara. Wonderful statement that
the images.
Is that the monkey in the building, in the house?
Yes.
Well, looking out the window?
Well, yeah, there's a window, but that's jumping a little ahead.
He should be.
Because we have to get...
he's not in the house yet.
He's not in the house. We have the monkey.
He's jumping around.
Is this the third one?
Yeah.
This is the third one.
There's the monkey.
Yeah,
there's the monkey. Okay, so the monkey's doing. He's in a house, but he's just on the outside of the house. He hasn't gotten inside yet. Name and form is the next giving rise to the name and form. So this is where the person in a boat.
Yeah, that's down there.
Yeah, there we go. Mm-hmm. And so that is giving ourselves a function, a significance, making a home, a conceptual box for ourselves. We flesh out our identity. And we're actually giving rise to the notion of a physical body, which is appropriated by consciousness. So that, in turn, gives rise to the sixth sense field, which is the six-windowed house. So there we are, right there. That's the house. And sometimes there's a monkey inside it, at least, but fundamentally it's empty. And that refers to the sixth sense field. So we're talking about the organs of perception. They're called ayatanas in Sanskrit. And it provides some sense of comfort or security because we have basically, we have some sense of containment with our sense field. It also leads to a sense of paranoia because there's more. But, you know, we have this fundamental kind of sense of a space to work with. The next thing, that gives rise to contact. So that's indicated by the married couple in the house, in a small house. And that's basically developing a personality. It's recognizing using the sense organs to objectify situations. Are we together on this so far? Any questions? Please raise your hand if at any point this is like needs more clarification. We don't have a lot of time to spend on all of this, you know, extensively. So we want to leave some room for discussion. We have that lead in terms. So the contact then. I have
a quick question of clarification. So is it fair to say that contact is also akin to recognizing other?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. We're already getting other. We're getting into male and female. We're making distinctions when we get that far. We're getting into role-playing when we do that. We're starting to see distinctions between things, between ourselves and others. And so we're already starting going through this process. We've already been trying to work at some sense of definition. And the contact gives us a lot more possibility of elaborating on that. So we have a word, diplomacy, trying to manage experiences. So we...
would that include friend? Then that would be friend and foe. Friend
oh, yeah.
and foe.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm curious, why a married couple then? I just think that's kind of odd.
Well, it's
is that the symbolism there of contact, not friend
yeah.
and foe? It seems to me that's a more comprehensive, that would be a much more comprehensive way of...
Well, it is relationship. But it's very primitive at this point. It's not elaborated into a, you know... that's coming down the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're embracing.
They're embracing.
So
it really goes back to whoever made this, and that's why that's there.
Well, it goes beyond that.
Yeah. I think it's about touch, though. Like, that you suddenly are understanding that, you know, you're connecting to other.
Well, you recognize yourself because you're in a relationship with other. I mean, and that's a very intimate relationship.
Right. So is friend
other.
And foe.
Though. Clearly, absolutely. And lovers are very often friend and foe.
Well, this is before we haven't defined friend and foe yet. We're moving there now.
Okay, got it.
So we're getting to feeling. And feeling is, actually, I'm looking for the person with the arrow in the eye.
There you go.
Can you see that?
Yeah, it's right here. The arrow's right there.
Yeah, the
people
arrow.
People are looking on and looking in dismay.
Yeah. There are people looking, but basically...
I would too, so the arrow in the eye.
So the arrow in the eye refers to, you know, basically some feedback level, getting rebound. We're putting things out, and finally it's coming
Ooh.
Back to us. And that's experiencing acceptance and rejection, success and failure, and... we're also, it's based around these fundamental primitive notions of pleasant, unpleasant, or indifferent. So, again, we're still pretty much in ourselves, although we see others. That then...
Roberta?
I'm just looking at the end of feeling. It says being alive in the world.
Yeah.
I think of that as such a good thing.
But. Yeah, well, it's not saying everything's bad here. We're just talking about process.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the important thing is trying to understand how this is the inevitable process that goes on and whether we simply have to become pushed along by our automaticity. You
okay.
know what I mean?
Okay.
Just where we're just on automatic and being pushed through life.
We're not
and
aware.
We have no idea how we got here.
But
and no idea where we're going.
Yeah.
All we know is it happens to us. You know, so we're just, everything is just completely on automatic. And so we're trying to figure out how we can look at this differently. So feeling then goes into craving. Craving has to do with some sense of effortless consumption or indulgence. And basically, craving is not, you're not necessarily in an addictive mode of consumption, but it's just continuously happening. And of course, it increases the desire for pleasantness and rejecting things that are unpleasant. And then there's a term of abiding in indifference. When we're just there without any particular kind of judgment about it, we're just sort of like, you know, in the state of passivity, as it were. That in turn, because of the nature of craving, we go into grasping. And grasping, so basically...
Can we back up for a second? That indifference and passivity. So you mean passivity towards this state of consumption?
It's like being in a state of just indifferent, like it's total neutrality, but dense neutrality. It's not a live neutrality where you're actually paying attention so much. It's just you don't care. It's not something
like a detachment.
Yeah, it's kind of a numb quality without any particular sharpness to it at all. A dullness.
The word meh, would that be about right?
Yeah.
So then we get into grasping, and this gets to be a couple. This is a much more complex. They're all very complex, but this one has the quality of going after more and more, and actually getting into a very exhilarating, exuberant quality. Could be falling in love. It's basically starting to actually develop a very focused direction of having fun. As you know, everybody wants to have fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And very eager involvement in things. There's four types of grasping here. One is at objects. One is holding wrong views. And another, which is related, is a bias to favored ways. In other words, we tend to want to push something that we are familiar with and like, and we feel threatened by things that we don't like, so we just try to lay it on other people, and particularly holding to a self, I mean grasping to self, cherishing oneself, right? This is that's further down the road as we develop more and more of a sense of sophistication or finishing to this touch of this so-called somebody who exists called me. That then, in turn, leads to becoming. That is represented by copulation.
It's just two people in bed together.
Yeah, they're in bed. Here we go.
There we go.
We're not just a married couple, we're actually doing it, you know.
We're actually
experiencing and expressing passion. And this is sometimes called existence. It comes from the desire not only that someone's out there, but you really want to share your experience with someone else. You want to have a companion. It's not like you simply acknowledge there are the people out there who are other people, but you really want to feel like someone can share your experience. And at that point, we actually get very caught. We've already gotten caught by this grasping process, so that the... we're getting caught and captured by our experience, and captured. We know that falling in love, generally speaking, as far as I know, other people might have a different point of view, is definitely an impermanent proposition. I mean, the thing could change, but it's not that intoxication. That, you know, that's something that actually is useful for people to overcome each other's potential criticism that they might have towards each other when they just are willing to give it all up and just throw themselves at each other. So, you know...
Did you say impermanent or permanent?
Impermanent. Don't you remember?
This is all
just checking.
I'm sorry.
Just checking. Yes, yes.
So,
count back how many marriages we
have. Yeah, right. further relating to another mind or body... And also, it does involve a heightened perception and a recognition of difference at the same time. So this is The next step, obviously, the natural consequence of copulation is birth, which is represented by a woman giving birth.
Irritation follows.
Totally written by a mom.
So, birth is here, woman giving birth, parenthood. It's basically, for those of us who have had children, you know that there is a certain joy connected with having birth, and then there is a lot of basic irritation. You know, this is oftentimes when the end of the real end of the honeymoon. So,
don't go in the marriage counselor. You would be a total failure.
Thanks. I mean, actually, it makes perfect sense. But you do have at this point the possibility of questioning how we got here. You know, how did this happen, right? I mean, and of course, you already start to recognize the possibility of danger to the child and the whole possibility of death and sickness and the concerns that start to develop around that rather than just having this great time. And recognize that there is going to be some kind of potential end to all this joyful fun we're having. And this dolls going pretty fast because the next thing, yes,
I mean, the way I was reading it was not the life, you know, not your apparent irritation pose, but just life irritation.
Sure.
Pose.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's not, it's really about your own experience.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's where the where things really start to rub you raw.
Yeah.
Because you know you're really experiencing something on another level besides just being caught up in your own little private world. For sure, you have to cope with other realities. And that's when things get challenging. And then very quickly, we move on to old age and death, which is...
Sure, here they are. That's the last...
The funeral procession.
It's the last one. He's carrying a corpse up there.
Yeah.
So wrapped up.
That's a funeral procession, and so that basically you begin to realize that, like, you know, you can't do it anymore, and all these things you loved and hated are all going to have to become. I have a note here for you in case you don't know what a charnel ground is, but it becomes an inspiration for the charnel ground. So that means the charnel ground is where we really have to face our own reality and work on ourselves. This is a very positive thing, by the way. Charnel ground, and we don't have them in the United States that I know of, at least not officially. There are plenty of unofficial ones, but
hospitals.
Hospitals, yeah. You know, places where people really have to deal. But in India, this is a traditional place where dead bodies were brought in for cremation and just left there, you know. And so you have all these wild animals and you have vultures and you have strange people showing up and hanging out in the charnel grounds. And this was a traditional place where the yogis would go because this is where you're going to, generally speaking, confront all your fears, all the things that nobody wants to deal with. I mean, think about Evelyn Waugh wrote this book called The Loved One, and it was all about the building of this cemetery in L.A., it's a very famous cemetery, and how just the whole thing about how we look at death as being something that it happens to other people and we just want to completely get it over with and move on to other things, you know. And this is this, but the charnel ground is really where really it happens. I mean, we really get down, as it were, to what we have to work with in terms of our passing experience, because this is happening on a moment-to-moment basis. And as we talked about, the sthanas are happening continuously. So are the nidanas. They are happening continuously. We can continually find ourselves emerging out of some state of a dream coming. It could be a day. You know, how we wake up, how we emerge out of sleep, a deep sleep, and, you know, suddenly dealing with being there, being somebody, and having to take a shower or do whatever we do, our oblations, and shuffling around and getting our day together. I mean, these things are happening continuously. And so,
how was old age and death? I don't really understand that. How is that?
That's where it all we go to sleep. As
you will.
If you want to think about it in terms of the day, it would be when
how
you
is it,
crash. Huh?
How is it? But how is
part
it
part of the chain?
Part of the chain of ignorance. I mean, or lack of understanding old age and death, or.
Well, it's happening because, you know, you were merged out of ignorance in terms of formation, consciousness, and name and form. All of these things are basically the birth process, so we're cycling through a life. This describes the process of life. You don't just, where we call birth, even though this is called birth, that's not really birth. That's not when you get born. It's not like, we've already been born for some time to have children and going through the grasping and copulation and all that, you know. This is, birth refers to basically a sense of actually experiencing responsibility and being a part of something else, right? Does that make sense?
That makes the old age, though. I don't understand how that is.
These are all the stages of life. So, old age and death follows life experience, and we are going to age and die. I have no question about that myself. Maybe other people here still entertain the possibility that it's not going to happen. But I can tell you, it will. So, what we're dealing with here is just the reality of what happens continuously. And we die, and then what? What does this whole thing amount to, right? I mean, we're looking at this cycle of experience that is, you know, is anybody in charge of this? Now, when we discover fundamentally how we're fundamentally addicted to our own fascination of of experience and objects and desire, we are actually caught up in ineluctably. I mean, it's everywhere, desire. We live in something called the desire realm. And that means we're in a body. When you're in a body, you have desires. There's no question about it. It's just part of having a body. You need to eat. You need to take care of yourself. You need to care for organic needs. These are all natural. It's not like desire is wrong. It's just a question of whether we can have any degree of control over our experience and desire and not simply have us have it drive us throughout the entire process of pain and suffering and confusion because we're just following the impulses that come into our mind. And so in the Hinayana, basically you take the point between craving and grasping, where that is a point where in our own experience we can actually easily see there's a possibility of cutting that relationship. We don't have to grasp even though we're craving. We can experience our craving, but we can also basically renounce the craving. We don't have to buy into it. We don't have to let it drive us. And so that's the basis for what we call renunciation. Renunciation actually does not mean I hate the world, I'm getting rid of it, I'm leaving, goodbye, you know. But it has to do with just simply a real commitment to non-attachment, realizing it's non-attachment that gives us freedom. As long as we are attached, we are not free. It's really simple. So this is where the traditional point of entering into the cycle and breaking the inevitability of it all. It doesn't mean that we won't end up dying or any of those other things, but it means that we don't have to perpetuate the experience of suffering as is defined by basically confusion of samsara. In the Mahayana, we start by asking, why is this happening in the first place? We start to investigate what is the nature of old age and death. And then we go backwards through these nidanas instead of starting from the beginning. And we take ourselves back through the process. So just like we did last week talking about the skandhas, we've talked about several weeks of the skandhas, learning about the mechanisms of mind and how confusion works, how it begins every second. One of the things I just wanted to bring up, I think, in the case of form, you know, it's very important that we remember how, I don't know if we studied form, as was taught by Trungpa Rinpoche, who had very profound insight that it's not just a perception of objects, but it's actually the momentary flickering of the mind that actually is happening so in such a rapid method. Every moment there is a continuous process of arising and ceasing, of birthing and deathing in terms of our experience. And this is very subtle, but it creates the fundamental ground for anxiety. And anxiety is probably the simplest way to describe what we call suffering in a classical sense.
Yeah.
So we go back to these points of the skandhas, and then we come back to ignorance, which is basically the big one, because that is the one that where we have to learn how to exhaust the ignorance. We talked a little bit about the alaya last week. We actually talked quite a bit about it. But the alaya is the personal alaya, as it were, because we still think we have a personal alaya, is to learn how we are actually exhausting our habitual patterns and confusion through the practice, through our spiritual practice, and then opening up ourselves to a greater dimension, a greater alaya, which is the alaya, the basic space of primordial wisdom, which is basically the foundation of everything. So first it's bad news, you know, and then it's good news, right? I mean difficult news in the sense of realizing we have to work on things. But at the same time, the point is that we're going to open ourselves up to the real basis of our experience, which is wisdom.
So would you say, it says in under ignorance, the root factor, the samadhi of samsara, it seems ignorance is really the foundation for all of the nidanas.
It is.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's not just...
Going forward, you go...
You don't leave it behind. It's.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You never leave ignorance behind. Sorry.
But then sort of what we've been studying is sort of we're trying to cut it right at the bottom, at ignorance.
Well, that's... I think that's rather advanced. I mean, when we talk about that, as we will study more and more Mahayana discipline, and we started with the slogans last year, which teach us about the basis. We learn about these training the slogans, and we learn ways to undo our own how we get involved in these various nidanas, and we're actually going backwards, as it were. To that point.
So we've worked our way back.
Well, yeah, when we get to that point of consciousness is like much more fundamental because we're overcoming duality. You know, consciousness is the birth of duality, when we say, because consciousness is all based on bifurcation, right? I and other, you know, me, you, up, down, right, left. I mean, the mind does work this way. We're not trying to get rid of duality, by the way. We just don't want to be controlled or trapped by it, imprisoned by it.
Attached.
So the
So ego. So you're right. I mean, if we look at what's in ignorance, in number one, as Michael said, the three marks of existence: impermanence, suffering, and egolessness. So we've been focusing on egolessness, and that's what I kept saying. We're going to the root. We're having a root canal here. So we're going to the root of suffering. And the root of suffering, one way to look at it is unraveling this solid self. So that's the big project that we're undertaking here. And it's key. It's key. And it's hard to see it. So, you know, we then, you know, have a lot of other ways of working with things and chopping off the branches and things. But getting to the root... Really understanding egolessness is really key.
It's so, like Roundup.
Roundup. It's Roundup. We're rounding up all of our...
All of the Roundup.
Yeah, I know. Roundup.
On the roof.
Good.
Yeah, that's great.
So the Heart Sutra is Roundup.
It is, actually.
Heart Sutra.
So what we're talking about here is the word interdependence, to go back to the key term we introduced, is basically the notion that everything is a process of and an expression of cause and effect, multiple causes and effects and conditions which give rise to those causes, to those effects and causes. But at the same time, from the Mahayana perspective, it also helps us, gives us an insight into the nature of emptiness. So emptiness is going to be seen from a variety of angles. as we recite in the Heart Sutra, you know, we recite this and we're going, okay, okay, you know, like, whatever. Because it's very profound. You know, it's not like we can figure out what emptiness is. That's not how it works. We don't analyze and actually ultimately define emptiness. We can say about what it isn't, you can say, that's easy. But you can't really say what it is because it's beyond saying. And that's the point. So as we learn more and more about ways to approach emptiness, this interdependence is a very profound one, realizing that nothing exists of itself and that everything is fundamentally a web of interactive relationships and dynamics. When we actually look for the ultimate origin of those dynamics, we don't find anything. It's beyond our mind. It's beyond the reach of mind. And that is a key point. We don't just sort of go, oh yeah, okay, fine, forget it. I mean, we lean into that. And it's the leaning into it that is actually the path. When we bring our experiences onto the path, this is how we actually engage with the possibility of discovering nature, liberating thoughts. Because we're obviously, the thoughts are what's driving us to do this and that, make choices and be confused and unclear about where we are. Well, the more we examine the nature of our thoughts, the more we realize there's no basis to them. They have no presence. They have nothing. And when we actually, they cannot withstand any kind of scrutiny. We cannot find out where they arise from or where they dwell or where they go. And that's actually very helpful.
So Michael, you're saying that the work involved is this because of this, this because of this, this because of this, and so on, right?
Right.
That this is the...
Going around back.
This is the actual work process.
Yeah, the work process is going back. And I remember when I first studied this with another teacher, Kondo Rinpoche, mm-hmm. we actually talked about like almost doing a hopscotch thing of where you go from old age and death to birth to becoming, grasping, and you know, actually taking it back and using your body to try to actually put yourself in different places on this series of squares to help you get a feeling for the process of it's actually deconstruction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the simplest term putting it.
So is there something in the visual, like if you did cut the ignorance, is there something in the picture what would happen?
If you cut ignorance?
Yeah.
The whole thing disappears.
Oh, okay.
I mean, at that point, everything is Buddha field.
Okay.
We're talking about Buddha mind is the absence of confusion.
I guess number six would make more sense to me if it was actually called relationship. Because I'm going backwards. I'm like, okay, yeah. And then I get from seven to six. I'm like, contact. It seems like it would go seven to five. But then when I read contact and it talks about relationships, then it makes more sense.
Yeah, I mean, we have to have... The feeling comes from some kind of contact.
Right.
Right?
As in physical contact?
Yeah, we can start with sparsha. Sparsha in Sanskrit is that symbolized by this particular mudra. And basically, it's like feeling cloth. You know, contact.
Sparsha. Mm-hmm.
Peter? The way that I had learned the 12 Vedanas was somewhat different, and I wanted to ask you if it might relate to how you're laying it out, which is that from 8 on, what's actually happening, the grasping and becoming and the birth, that's talking about the becoming and the birth of the self. That's the way I learned it. That's actually where the self gets created and solidified as a separate, inferred, separate entity. And that was what I learned actual becoming is. And the becoming happens because of the grasping. So if that can be cut before the grasping, then all that happens, you know, 1 through 8, sure, there's all that's still taking place. But it's free of the inference of the separate self until the grasping comes in and says, I want.
Well,
and
actually...
And then I become.
Actually,
and that's the birth of me.
So we have what's called subliminal dynamics that are prior to any kind of ultimate emanation of some rooster suddenly popping out of an egg and walking around saying, I am, you know, and hogging up the barnyard. I mean, we're talking about what precedes that with all these earlier things. Now, they have a liberated aspect to themselves, because from the point of view of enlightenment, everything is completely pure. But when we talk about where we are as humans, where we find ourselves caught, we can actually work from that, the point of, at least to begin with, the point of craving and grasping, because actually when we actually experience craving, this is before we get to the point that you're talking about of actually fully blowing up into an identity. But these dynamics occur before that identity. These are habits that occur, and they support this identity. Identity is kind of sitting up on top of the whole heap and saying, I am the whole thing, you know, this is me, blah, blah. But how can, what's that based on? See, we're looking at actually, you can't even, you're not going to get rid of the fundamental underlying current, the undercurrents.
Right, I'm not saying you would.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that what's happening in from nine on is the emergence of the self, the sense of separate self. And that all the stuff that's happening before that is happening all the time. But there's not really the sense of a separate self yet until the grasping starts to create that process 9 through 12.
Well, I would say...
You've already said that, Michael.
Neurosis, as we call it, precedes even that, the self. So it's because the self is simply made up of a bunch of neuroses.
So are you saying that the self is already there before we get to 9?
The neurosis is already implicit. We carry the whole notion of a self in the ignorance in the first place. Because we're carrying, if this is a cycle, the old age and death, the charnel ground is giving birth to a new cycle of ignorance, which then perpetuates itself again. It's not like it waits until it gets up to stage 9 and 10 to actually pop out and go, okay, here I am again.
Okay. Well, that's about you. The way you're explaining it, so... Okay, you cut it there. Now, does that mean no further cycling, or what? Where does death come in?
Pardon?
Where does death come in, then?
I think that there's still physical death, but there's the possibility of liberation from the illusion of a separate self.
Okay,
At 9. Between 8 and 9.
Okay, so, but the death comes in...
Or maybe between 7 and 8.
Does the forward cycling continue here, or not?
I don't know.
Well, these are two different explanations, which have independent validity, it seems to me.
But don't you say this, that the Hinayana's cut between... craving and grasping.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so from that point of view, it affirms exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that that's the point where we can actually establish some basic self-liberation.
Yeah. Right.
It's not ultimate liberation, but it is an essential liberation. If we don't know that we don't really exist, if we actually can ascertain that, you know, directly through our own experience, validate that through our practice, then we have some fundamental, we've established some fundamental freedom and capacity to do far more than just continuously replicate the same experiences over and over again. The Mahayana is going to be where we actually go further, because we're not only liberating all beings in the process, we're actually liberating phenomena, which is a much bigger project, obviously, than just only oneself or the notion of self. But the self in phenomena is much more subtle. That takes more, that's why they say it takes eons to do this. And so when you read about the various levels of bodhisattvas, the bhumis, what we call the bhumis, which are bodhisattva levels, they start from a point of view of complete liberation, of fundamental emptiness. The first level of the bodhisattva is where you don't go back to samsara. You're not going back again, but you're staying there working with it to continue to liberate samsara for everybody. You're not worried about liberating yourself anymore.
Other questions?
Comments? I think anybody can work with this stuff.
I can ask a question just on words. Mm-hmm. The word equanimity, I know, is big. And I'm wondering if we encountered like neutral and a couple of other equivalents. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you stay clear about saying they're all the same.
They aren't equivalent. I mean, no, equanimity is basically an evenness that is unwilling to become overwhelmed by either positive or negative experiences. But when we talk about neutral, it tends to refer to, you know, we have these three basic points. We talk about passion, aggression, and ignorance. The neutrality from that point of view is more of that. It's more non-agitated, but it doesn't mean that you're in some state of awareness or awake. You know, it just basically means you're not, you don't have a positive or negative response to it.
Are you asking a question?
Yeah, I'm asking for further distinctions.
Did that help?
Distinction of what?
Well, I'm interested in experiencing something intensely, mm-hmm. and not and having equanimity at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what, like you sort of said the opposite with that last statement you made. See, you used the three levels, ignorance and...
No, but you were using the word neutrality.
Yes.
In this case, neutrality is meant to describe something more ignorant rather than... it's simply indifferent to positive or negative. You're not having a negative or positive reaction.
Yes.
It tends to be more, you know, just...
Blank.
Not essentially important. You're not taking...
Right, but given that insight, how would you insert intensity of feeling in...
Amen. Well, we go further with teachings around fundamental equanimity as a freedom from extremes. That's how we would approach it in the Mahayana to begin with. So, you know, we're working in the sense of non-attachment. If you're not attached, even though you could experience something, you're not attached to the experience or the sensation, or these are byproducts of the experience. So the equanimity is willing to stay with the situation, as it were, right? Yes. Not being pushed in or out.
I like that being willing to stay with the situation.
Yeah, you're really actually right. You're not willing to abandon the situation because they're painful so necessarily. You're not concerned about the pleasure.
It's really hard to do that.
Well, we train. This is where the practice is important. It's not like, you know, it's more of something that actually just emerges of itself. This is going much further in terms of simply understanding the power of primordial sanity, you know. And when we talk about Buddha nature, we're talking about basic sanity. Sanity, awareness itself doesn't care. If we actually start to get more familiar with awareness, we realize awareness doesn't care whether something hurts or it feels good. It doesn't. It's just aware.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But we're on this other side of that, where we're just waiting for the reaction to show up whether we feel good about it or not.
Right. Good.
That's a common theme to stay with things that we've been bringing up. And in my practice, I've been noticing that, just like you said, it's not the staying, it's not the actual phenomenon that's happening that's not comfortable, it's the resistance. Mm-hmm. It's that resistance, and when you stay with it, whatever it is, be it good or bad, it's actually not that bad at all. It's the discomfort comes from the resistance, the discomfort for me, and that's been a big realization I've had. Mm-hmm.
So for me, I think number 9 is really key, the grasping. Mm-hmm. And what comes to me also is that the liberation comes being willing to be uncomfortable with the craving, and that's a general all-encompassing idea, not just one little thing I want, but bigger than that. And then you don't... Often the grasping and the fulfillment is filling the hole of emptiness, filling some hole, or which then reinforces the self. I think there's a lot of pieces in there that are really big, important. So I think that really deserves contemplation.
I keep thinking about the discipline to give up something like smoking cigarettes or whatever, that, or any substance that you have to describe this craving, and you know that the next thing you could do is grasp.
Yes.
And to have the discipline or and the sort of mental capacity to simply not to recognize there's a difference between the craving and the grasping, and stop that karmic grasping is huge. It's a huge leap in one's...
well, we can make that choice. It's a simple capacity to make a simple choice of saying yes or no.
I think you said the recognition. I think that's key, because once you recognize it, it dissipates.
And it dissipates. Yeah. In our space.
I was just going to say, creating the space.
Yes,
that's right.
Create the space between the two, and then you can recognize it.
That's right.
You've got to have that beat.
That's right.
The beat.
And it's even not responding to provocation or, you know, the triggers, what all of our triggers to get mad or react.
You can be in that space and see it and then go, fuck it. to grab a hold of it.
I think this would only, if anything, reinforce the importance of meditation practice.
Right.
Because in our meditation practice, we're basically allowing ventilation to come between our thoughts, giving ourselves space between one thought and the next. And we begin to just let that go. So the connectivity starts to weaken, and we're not just in this chain link series of, one thing following another. And so the cutting is actually, there are times when it actually seems very dynamic, and I'm actually out there doing the cutting, and there are other times when it just simply resolved by itself by opening yourself up to the space, which you didn't recognize before because you were too busy caught up with the thought. So, this helps us.
Or the heightened emotion, as you were just describing. You get caught up in the heightened intensity of it, and then you feel like you have to act. Well, that's a kind of form of grasping.
And Pema talks about even if you have to distract yourself, to do anything else, to break that habit of then grasping from that craving, that's acceptable, as long as you're just doing something different than what you always do.
Liberation.
Wonderful.
Yay.
Okay, well, we've passed our bewitching hour.